Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, D.C. drama, two bills and a possible government shutdown on the way. CNBC's Ilan Moy.
The administration is starting to frame and move the debate away from that $3.5 trillion number, which has triggered so much angst within the party, and say the really net cost of this bill is zero because we're going to pay for it completely over time.
Our new normal may be here. It's just not exactly what we expected. Former FDA head Dr. Scott Gottlieb.
We're going to evolve to a place where this is an endemic virus and becomes a way of life or a fact of life, if you will.
And a $40 million conference call, an impersonated YouTube executive, and Aussie Media's audience numbers.
If you go on the website or YouTube, the numbers for the show are very, very high. There are very few comments. It's possible that they could have been buying traffic from other places.
Those stories, plus Germany after Angela Merkel and social media's got us squawking.
I think we should do a squawk TikTok.
Well, you and Becky enjoy that.
Nope.
It's Monday, September 27th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning. Welcome to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Becky Quick, along with Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin.
We're going to get right to today's top story. It is the drama over the weekend in Washington, D.C. For that, Ilan Moy is here to take a look at everything investors need to be watching this week. Good morning to you.
Well, good morning, Andrew. Democrats are starting to map out a path for passing President Biden's economic agenda while hopefully avoiding a government shutdown in the process. Now, today at 5:30 p.m., the Senate will vote on a bill that would fund the government through December 3rd and raise the debt ceiling through next year. But Republicans are still determined to oppose this, leaving Democrats just 3 days to come up with a plan B before the government runs out of money on September the 3rd. Now, Treasury has a little more breathing room before it hits the debt limit. As of Friday, it had about $244 billion worth of cash and extraordinary measures left. The Bipartisan Policy Center projects the so-called X date will fall between October 15th and November 4th. And Democrats are also making a final push on infrastructure. The House will start debating the bill on the floor today with a final vote now scheduled for Thursday. Now, President Biden spoke with Democratic leadership before he left for Camp David this weekend, and he sounded confident about the bill's prospects when he returned.
I'm optimistic about this week. It's going to take the better part of the week, I think.
But of course, this is all contingent on whether Democrats can hash out an agreement on that $3.5 trillion social spending package this week as well. So, guys, this really is make or break for the party. Back over to you.
I got a question for you about, I don't know if you saw it. Maybe Joe and Becky also saw it. It was buried in a New York Times article over the weekend. It was about taxes and about, we know about Manchin, but I didn't know about Senator Sinema saying effectively, I will not raise taxes, either corporate or individual taxes. A Democratic senator saying that, and it struck me. I was actually surprised it wasn't the headline of the story, sort of where you think everybody really is at this point.
Yeah, it's hard to believe that she would not raise taxes at all. I mean, what I've heard and sort of the consensus on the Hill is that it's unlikely she would go any higher than Joe Manchin would go. So there's two people already at, let's say, 25% for the corporate rate. But they're going to have to raise taxes on corporations or on the wealthy in order to pay for this plan. It's really interesting when you hear how the administration is starting to frame and move the debate away from that $3.5 trillion number, which has triggered so much angst within the party, and say the really net cost of this bill is zero because we're going to pay for it completely over time. And so that way they can get away from, is it 3.5? Is it 2? Is it 1.5? Is it 1? And talk about what are the priorities for spending in the bill and promise that it's all going to be paid for. We'll see.
But the CBO doesn't score it as zero either.
Well, the CBO score has not come out yet, so we haven't seen the full cost of spending because Democrats haven't decided what that is. But even for the House version of the bill, we are waiting on the CBO score for that. The JCT does say that the tax provisions that were in the House version of the bill raise roughly $2 trillion.
Pelosi said yesterday that the $3.5 trillion number, it's not going to be that big. Is she meaning that they're going to take things out, or is she meaning that we're just going to change what we think the cost is for all of the same stuff?
Well, I think that's a debate right now. So one way that Democrats could potentially dial back the cost of the program is by making each of these different priorities last for a shorter period of time. So, for example, in the House version of the bill, the child tax credit would go through 2025. Maybe instead it goes through 2024 and you get a little bit of savings there. So there are different ways that they can either change the end date or the start date of different programs to be able to bring down the number. The question is, what moderates are pushing for is, instead of having a lot of programs that last for a short period of time, they want to make what they're calling big investments in a number of key priorities that last for a long time. So do you do a few things and do them, you know, perhaps permanently or for a long period of time? Or do you try to get everything in there, but then you're facing, you know, another reauthorization in maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
That sounds
years.
Like a pretty key philosophical debate. I mean, if you still can't figure that out, if we're going to do all these programs or just a few for a longer time, maybe they are quite a bit further off than we think of potentially reaching anything.
Yeah, I'm really not sure how they reach agreement this week, but that's what they say that they're going to be doing. You know, they said last week that they had some sort of framework on the tax piece of it. What we sort of realized was that the framework was what the framework had always kind of been. So there is the messaging around this, and then there's, you know, being able to sit down and write out the details of the legislation.
And the idea that it's free, that suddenly because we're not just adding it on to the overall debt, I mean, that's a semantic argument that was met with the at least in a lot of circles, the biggest eye roll I've ever seen in my life. So, yeah, it's free. Anyway, thanks, Alon. In global political news, Social Democrats in Germany narrowly beating outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel's alliance. Did you know all these years that she was the conservative side of things?
Yes.
That just shows you what a conservative in Europe looks like. She's stepping down after 16 years as chancellor. Now there's going to be coalition talks and a possible three-way power-sharing agreement. But the scuttlebutt is a weakened government for years as China is ascendant. So at least that's one way of looking at it, because we need a strong Europe, obviously. And Germany is, you know, key to a strong EU. If that lasts, but you know, especially with
it was a very close vote, though, it's, between the two parties.
Weak,
they're
yeah.
both moderate parties, the slightly left and the slightly right. There, it was very close between them, but they're not. The two of them are not going to be the ones that combine to make the party. The center left government is going to have to go a little further left with the liberals and the greens, and so you see what happens with that. The liberals don't want to raise taxes; they want to expand the programs. The Greens want to raise taxes, but usually what happens when they start doing that is they get rid of the things they disagree on. So maybe there won't be higher taxes on the wealthy or on corporations, but you can't expect that they will extend their spending.
And she's out of there. She's so out of there.
16 years.
And actually,
she went out with higher approval ratings than she came 70 in with.
70% plus.
Right.
She has. And then the Journal has an interesting piece about Speaker Pelosi that not exactly the same, but that she may be gone in a year or two in 2022, and that this is the final sort of the swan song that will hurt a lot of the people that she's whipping or whatever you want to call them when you're getting votes, that it's the death sentence for some of those people if they go along with this in moderate areas. But she's not going to care.
Yeah.
She's going to have the legacy of you know, getting things transforming, as she says, it's transformational, building back better, and all these. If it's free, it's transformational, it's building back better, all those things. In other news out of Europe, so we got that. I tweeted that over the weekend. So it's free. So we got that going for us, which is nice. And then people were actually answering with other Caddyshack quotes.
I wish it was free.
I know.
But by the
way,
in fairness, just to say it, because we should say it, the other plans weren't free prior either.
No, that's nothing's ever free that they do. We know that.
But there wasn't as there was.
Sometimes what got added to the
conversations
debt.
We had back then. You were
This has to do with
but
prescription drugs.
I don't think
paid
that we're going to pay
with
pay
prescription
for it.
Drugs.
But I didn't think the last program we'd pay for.
Yeah,
and I don't think this program we'd pay.
No,
for.
We don't. But there's a lot of sleight of hand in this too, with prescription drugs and all kinds of things. And when you do raise taxes, it's not free because it's money that.
Oh, you're talking about raising taxes now.
No. Well, when you do raise taxes,
that's not
to call it free is you're paying for it, with, and it's coming from somewhere else where it may or may not be treated better.
Does it trouble you what took place in the prior 4 years in terms of how much money was spent and the fact that that wasn't free?
Are you going, this is what you're thinking.
No, I
does
actually,
it trouble you that liberals
does,
don't look at
both sides?
The New York Times
me.
Never
it's,
looked
the
at
both
anything.
Both sides of this trouble.
Are
me
you ever
going to
criticize Biden for anything?
Yes,
Afghanistan, the border.
Yes, mistake.
Really?
Mistake.
Okay,
let's say it.
I just usually you're just you know.
I'm happy to say it. Let's say it.
No one depending
let's say
on
the
which
way,
side
the
of the
execution of getting out of Afghanistan
okay.
was
how about
was,
the border
was a mistake.
How about the border?
Having said that, we but. Contextualize it.
Does it seem like things are going well for the past
why
8 months?
Why did we get out of Afghanistan? In part because President
right,
Trump had set
right,
the timeline.
Okay.
So let's just contextualize it.
Do you feel like you are equal in terms of looking at Democrats and Republicans and criticizing? Do you think the New York Times is
think,
and basically?
I'm not going to speak on behalf of different newspapers or different news. I can speak on behalf of myself. I think that I try. I think I try, and I think
no
on a relative basis,
there.
I think I'm much closer to the center, and I think I'm much closer to where the viewer actually is on that in that regard.
I don't know. I have some weird people following me then on Twitter.
Meantime, some fascinating news just breaking this morning. Instagram now putting an upcoming product on hold for kids. This comes in the wake of a series of critical articles about Facebook in the Wall Street Journal, including one that accused Facebook of knowing that Instagram is bad for teen girls' mental health. Instagram's head, Adam Mosseri, joined the Today Show just moments ago.
Today, we want to talk about how we're going to put the work on pause. I still firmly believe that it's a good thing to build a version of Instagram that's designed to be safe for tweens. But we want to take the time to talk to parents and researchers and safety experts and get to more consensus about how to move forward.
And Facebook pushing back on that journal article in a blog post yesterday, saying that on many well-being issues, Instagram's own research showed that the service actually helps teen girls, although teens reported both positive and negative experiences with social media. It's an interesting one because the blowback has been huge. I've even heard from potential advertisers saying, you know, I don't know if I want to be associated with Facebook, don't want to be associated with Instagram. It's an interesting also decision to put a pause on this kids program.
Yeah.
One of the challenges, unfortunately, is that lots of tweens and kids under the age of 13, unfortunately, are already using the service. And so to some degree, you could argue better to actually have a service that has some kind of controls around it. But at the same time, there's so many issues around trust right now that they're putting that pause in place.
I don't know. It seems like a really tricky one when you open up the service and say it's actually for open for kids under 13 instead of kids who are kind of like squeaking into it and using it. This has been an issue I've been concerned about as a mom, and you know, seeing them actually say, "Okay, we're going to bow to the pressure on this and put the hit the pause button," I think is a bit of a victory.
It's interesting. I can't tell whether it's a victory or not. There's part of me that thinks it's a victory, but there's part of me that thinks
one.
That there's so many kids, for better or worse, on this service already that if you could actually put some controls in place, that maybe that's an improvement.
Why don't you put controls on it to make sure that kids under 13 aren't on it?
Well, that's by the way, that's the big question. Can you? And I think that they've tried. I don't know if they've maybe
really
tried hard enough.
really hard
you know, the question is, how do you get there in terms of protecting against that?
I don't know. Ask for a parental sign off and the parent has to be on Facebook first to approve it.
I believe that it's very hard to actually just sign. I don't think you can just sign up an account straight up.
Well, this is where I don't like, you know, oversight and regulation. But, you know, kids left to their own devices
right.
at that age.
But
it's
again,
hideous.
Including the
similar
parents
problem
in it.
On TikTok,
right.
by the way,
right.
and some of these other services.
You know, those people who can't dance.
Agree with that. The
people,
TikTok.
People who can't dance.
They look really bad. They shouldn't be dancing.
Doing a little bit of this?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Do they? Have you done it?
I have not done it. I think we should do a squawk TikTok. I do think we should.
Well, you and Becky enjoy that.
No, I was going to count myself out. That can be you too.
Solo performance, is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Watch me.
Next on Squawk Pod, when will it all be over? Nearly 700,000 Americans have died due to COVID-19, but maybe we're approaching a new era of the pandemic. Dr. Scott Gottlieb.
It's going to be an evolution. It's not going to happen overnight, and I don't think the vaccines are going to be what drive us out of this. It's going to be when we can vaccinate the children, when prevalence declines, when the hospitalizations and deaths start to decline. And they will.
Viral medicines, kids' vaccines, and a new normal. Right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
This is Squawk Pod with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Here's Becky.
Pfizer's CEO is predicting that there could be a return to what he called normal life within the next year amid the continued pandemic. In an interview yesterday, Albert Bourla stressed that normal doesn't necessarily mean that COVID would be completely gone and that the variants would continue being an issue. Bourla says that that means annual revaccinations could become a part of life.
Because the virus is spread all over the world, that we will continue seeing new variants that are coming out, and also we will have vaccines that they will last at least a year. And I think the most likely scenario is annual revaccinations, but we don't know really. We need to wait and see the data.
So maybe it becomes much more like the flu. On the topic of vaccinations for children, Bourla says that it's a question of days, not weeks, before Pfizer submits data to U.S. regulators for authorization. And guys, that would put it to the position where maybe kids can get these vaccines by about Halloween, because it takes 4 to 6 weeks generally for the FDA to approve.
Meantime, another big issue in New York. This is happening basically right now. The governor may be calling up the National Guard and use out-of-state medical workers to fill some hospital staffing shortages. Tens of thousands of healthcare workers could lose their jobs if they don't meet today's deadline. It is today for a mandated COVID vaccination.
Get the Gottlieb. After the CDC recommended booster shots for some Americans, confusion still remains regarding eligibility and rollout of a third Pfizer vaccine. Join us now, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner, CNBC contributor. He also serves on the boards of Illumina and Pfizer. His new book, Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic, is out now. So many nuances to the vaccine, Scott. I, you know, frustrating because the panacea we had hoped for, it's not even close. Breakthroughs and viral loads of double vaccinated people and all these things. What about a therapeutic that we could get in the form of a pill like we use with other viruses? It's definitely possible to do. Pfizer's working on one. Merck and Ridgeback are close to disrupting the replication of the virus, which turns it into not even a serious flu almost. Plus, The viral load never gets high enough to cause those immune system problems that we get that kill so many people with COVID. That's the only way we're ever getting out from underneath this. A booster every year and another one and breakthrough cases. Vaccines aren't going to be the answer to get us back to normal.
Well, I wouldn't accept that vaccines aren't going to be the answer. We don't know what the long-term immunity is going to be, especially after you boost the population. This might be a three-dose regimen. It might be an annualized vaccine like we take for flu. And the vaccines are holding up pretty well. They're fulfilling their original premise that they're preventing hospitalization, severe disease, even symptomatic disease in most cases. With respect to the therapeutic, there is news out today from Pfizer, the company I'm on the board of, about advancing their drug into clinical trials to prevent infection in close contacts. You're right, the Merck drug is advanced as well. Roche has a drug that's also in advanced development, a little further behind, but looks very promising. And then there's a whole host of drugs that are in earlier development that were engineered specifically to target this SARS-CoV-2 virus. I do believe we're going to have an antiviral. To your point, this isn't a hard virus to drug in terms of how it replicates. But I'll just offer that it's going to become increasingly difficult to run these clinical trials in a population where you have a lot of people who've been vaccinated and a lot of people who've been infected. So, you know, running a trial to prevent progression of symptomatic disease or to prevent the onset of disease in close contacts is difficult to find treatment-naive patients or virus-naive patients in the United States right now.
That's a good problem to have. Obviously, Scott, that you can't find people that...
Well, it's a good problem to have if the reason why you can't find people is because they're vaccinated.
Right.
It's not a good problem if it's that they're infected.
But so aren't you... what I can't understand is the angst and the you know, seeing masks everywhere again. What we thought was going to be different, what was it, 3, 4, 5? I got it in January. So what looked like the end is nowhere near the end because of these breakthrough cases, whether they're... really, really common, whether you're asymptomatic doesn't seem to matter anymore. Even if you're asymptomatic with a breakthrough case, there's still a concern that you're going to pass it to someone who's vaccinated, and then they're going to be asymptomatic, and it's going to keep getting passed until you get to someone who's either vulnerable or who's unvaccinated. And it's just like this vicious circle. That it's very frustrating. And everybody's out. I mean, look at, I mean, maybe they're outside, maybe they're not. There's people inside, there's people in stadiums, there are people everywhere, and you know, you get a dirty look if you're not wearing a mask, even if you're double vaxxed.
Well, look, let me just challenge that for a minute. First of all, you're right. Everyone's out. I mean, society is functioning fairly normally. I'm not going to say it's completely normal right now, but prevalence is still very high. We're still recording 2,000 deaths a day, a lot of hospitalizations. This Delta wave is still sweeping across the country. So I think that's impacting behavior and psychology. And I think it's going to take a longer time for psychology to really evolve, where we come to accept coronavirus as just a fact of life and that there's going to be infections. But that's going to be a point when prevalence really starts to decline and we start to see fewer hospitalizations, fewer deaths. We're still really in the throes of this. And then finally, I think the reason why a lot of people are overestimating the risk of coronavirus or are still concerned about it, even if they're vaccinated, know that they're not going to get very sick, but they might get a milder or asymptomatic infection, is because the kids are still vulnerable. I think once we're able to vaccinate children, once adults are able to vaccinate their kids, the anxiety about getting a breakthrough infection, knowing that you're probably not going to get very sick, your odds of getting very sick are very low if you're vaccinated, but you could bring it back into the house, I think that's going to start to resolve. So, you know, this is going to be a slow evolution. You're right. We've just spent a year and a half, you know, trying to prevent every single infection. And we're going to evolve to a place where this is an endemic virus and becomes a way of life or a fact of life, if you will. It's going to be an evolution. It's not going to happen overnight. And I don't think the vaccines are going to be what drive us out of this. It's going to be when we can vaccinate the children, when prevalence declines, when the hospitalizations and deaths start to decline. And they will. They will on the back end of this Delta wave.
Scott, can we talk about the booster for a second? This is the third booster available by Pfizer, not yet in the case in Moderna. In terms of the ability to get infected, one of the things we don't know from these studies, they talk about sort of the 9-10 times antibodies, but we don't know what that means in practice. If the original second shot got you to, let's say, a 93% rate, now that was pre-Delta, what do you think the third booster gets you to? Because part of it is people are trying to avoid hospitalization, death. But I do think there's a lot of folks, by the way, including myself, who would very much like to avoid infection. And it seems like, at least for several months after the shot or the first vaccine or maybe the third vaccine, that there is a level of which there's almost an inoculation, but maybe not.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a good question. In the public health community, the premise that these vaccines are going to be used to prevent any infection at all, that's where people start to get uncomfortable because they feel that the premise of these vaccines is that they should be used to prevent severe disease, symptomatic disease, hospitalization. That was the original concept of the vaccines. And in order to prevent any infection at all, you might need to continue to reboost to maintain high circulating antibody levels. Now, the data out of Israel, to directly answer your question, and it's only 1 month of data that we're really looking at this point, some cases go out a little further than that, does suggest that the immune protection that the third shot offers restores the protection that you had after the second shot. So if the second shot afforded you 95% protection against any infection at all, that does appear to be what you're seeing after this third dose. Now, it's only short-term data. We don't know how durable the high levels of circulating antibodies are going to be in the protection against infection. So it's an open question right now. I mean, we're going to have to continue to follow these patients. But that premise that these vaccines should be used to prevent any infection at all, that's where public health officials and that's where the advisory committees got uncomfortable.
Scott, then the second question, this goes to where I think Joe was headed, which is if you're vaccinated and you get a breakthrough infection and you give it to another vaccinated individual who therefore gets a breakthrough infection, what do you think the demonstrable danger is in that context? Because Joe posited that they were going to be asymptomatic and asymptomatic. I know people who were asymptomatic and then symptomatic and worse.
Yeah. Well, again, we don't know. I mean, I'm inclined to believe, look, we're not collecting data on this, so we can't answer these questions. So this is, speculative. But I'm inclined to believe that more of the asymptomatic infections or mildly symptomatic infections that we're seeing in vaccinated people isn't vaccinated people getting the infection from other vaccinated people. It's vaccinated people getting the infection from unvaccinated people, more likely, because a vaccinated person probably is shedding less virus and is contagious for a shorter period of time. That's what this study seems to suggest. There's no reason to believe that an infection passed from a vaccinated person to a vaccinated person is going to be any worse. You can speculate that it would be less worse because a vaccinated person is less likely to shed a lot of virus and give you a big dose of virus. And the severity of your infection is, in some cases, dose-dependent. How big of a dose of the virus did you get before you got infected? Probably you got a lower dose from a vaccinated person. Again, speculation, because CDC isn't collecting this data, so we can't answer the question definitively.
So back to the original point. These therapeutics, these pills could be, you could have an EUA before the end of the year, almost before the end maybe before winter, before December 20th.
Yeah, with the trials that are underway looking at reduction in symptoms and prevention of progression of severe disease, those are the first trials that got underway. Yes, those are well underway, the pivotal trials. You could have a readout from Pfizer and Roche and Merck before the end of the year that could lead to an EUA potentially if everything goes well. The trials looking at prevention of infection in close contacts got started later, so they're going to read out later.
Right, but that's a game changer because remdesivir is just, the whole process is... It's almost like a catch-22.
Yeah, it has to be infused.
Yeah, it's almost like, and you got to do it early.
Right. And look, we have the monoclonal antibodies. We need to remember the monoclonal antibodies are highly effective. They're available right now, and it could be used as a prophylaxis. They're available for prophylaxis. Now, again, they need to be infused, but Vir Biotechnology is working on a sub-Q formulation that could be delivered in a doctor's office. So those are very good drugs, so we shouldn't lose sight of that. I think people don't really reach for them because they seem to be complicated to administer, but they're really not.
Good. Need all these arrows in the quiver, Scott. Thanks.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, the story that got us squawking today and was highlighted in the New York Times Media Equation column. Ozzy, the startup with huge audience numbers and high-profile backers, and the Wall Street conference call that went wrong. All wrong.
Clearly, Lazary must have known about this. I'm imagining he has confidence in the company. But clearly, Goldman Sachs doesn't have confidence. And the big question is going to be whether advertisers will have confidence.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. And there's a story today in the New York Times that caught our interest about a past Squawk Box guest, a $40 million investment, and a wild conference call. Here's Andrew.
We got to talk about this Goldman Sachs, Aussie, vest, everything mess story in today's Times by Ben Smith, because it is
What did you think? I mean, kind of reading through... It looked like Goldman Sachs had forget it, but then they decided to move forward anyway with an additional round of funding that they were seeking after that.
Just to bring everybody up to speed, the story in the Times this morning suggests that Ozzy, and we've had Carlos Watson, we actually just had Carlos and Mark Lazary on the program last week after they announced a new funding round, and Mark Lazary, I believe, was becoming chairman of the company. Carlos, I should probably let you take it away in terms of what the news is, but in a way, Mark is about to become at least one of your bosses.
Always has been, always will be. And I'm really pleased to announce this morning that Mark Lazary has joined us as the chairman of our board.
So, Mark, what's the plan here? When you think about the future of Ozzy, when you think about the future of media companies, what's the long-term play here?
I think for us, Aussie Media is a pretty unique company. I joined the board a number of years ago, and it's just literally revenue has kept on doubling.
A wild story about how Carlos Watson's co-founder effectively tried to impersonate somebody from YouTube in a conference call with Goldman Sachs. Lots of questions about whether
in order to say something about how great their numbers were and give the impression that they were reaching a bigger audience than.
And lots of questions about whether their audience really is the size that they say. ComScore, which is an outside service that audits these things and has their own numbers. I don't want to say audits these things, but estimates their own numbers. Their numbers are way below where it appears that Carlos Watson has told people publicly
If the guy with the disguised voice was an outlier, it'd be one thing. But there's a whole series of
things that were hyped up with Amazon
and
all sorts of things.
But Ben Smith, I kind of take issue with this.
What's that?
He throws Tesla under the bus, kind of. One nagging question in this era of spectacular boom and buses, where do you draw the line between fake it till you make it and possible fraud? And he says fake it till you make it was Tesla. He says, as an example.
I think that there were things that were said.
But Tesla and Theranos in the same sentence should
different.
Those two should never be in the same sentence.
Agreed. But I think that there were questions early on in what was said.
They begin with a T.
But in terms of this Aussie story, the other thing that's so fascinating to me about it is if you get to the very bottom of it, you realize that even though they did raise $40 million, Emerson, which is Lorene Powell-Jobs' firm, was an early investor in Aussie,
and
they distanced themselves from it and effectively say, we haven't been putting new money into this company, and actually we're off the board. So while Mark Lazary may be out there, and we'd love for Mark or Carlos invitation to call into the show right now even to talk about it.
But is it a dirty little secret that
I think there's been a lot of questions about
all social
Carlos's
media
show.
Eyeballs inflated by.
Well, I think there's
a dirty little secret.
This is different. It appears that this may be different.
But is it a matter of degree? It's a quantitative difference, not a qualitative difference? Does everybody do it to some extent?
I don't know.
You put on the best face.
I don't know. I will say that...
Well, somebody said that there were questions about whether this would... Ben wrote this in the piece, whether there were questions about whether the SEC could look into this. Because if you are making false allegations in reference to investments... that they could potentially have a case. He said maybe not because the investment didn't move forward after they found out that it was a fraud.
I will say it's very interesting. If you go on Carlos's show, and by the way, I should say I was a guest on Carlos's show, but I'm saying if you go on the website or YouTube, the numbers for the show are very, very high, meaning it looks like millions of people have seen the show. Ben makes the point that there are very few comments on which does reflect that there's something going on. It's possible that they could have been buying traffic from other places. And I say, by the way, in full disclosure, I was on the show. It looks like millions of people saw that episode.
No, that was the lowest episode ever.
I would say maybe one or two people in my whole life have ever even have said to me, hey, I saw you on this thing. And I always thought to myself, that's a little strange because if you look at the numbers on it, they're very, very high.
What do you think Lazary's like? Who needs us? I'm a trillionaire. I mean, why am I?
Well, clearly Lazary must have known about this even when he came on our air, which, by the way, also troubles me. I want to say that because clearly this incident happened before he came on, before they had raised this money, and obviously wasn't acknowledged. He must have confidence in the. I'm imagining he has confidence in the company. But clearly Goldman Sachs doesn't have confidence. Clearly Lorene Powell-Jobs doesn't have confidence. And the big question is going to be whether advertisers will have confidence.
Right.
And that's Squawk Pod for today. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. Follow Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen to this podcast anytime. Thank you. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.